Hey everyone, welcome to Garden Fork Radio. You're here with Eric and my West Coast doppelganger, Eric. Welcome, sir.
Great to talk to you, Eric.
So this is Eric from Root Simple, who he and his wife have a really cool blog and a podcast now. And Eric has been on the show a couple times. And I just spur the moment yesterday said, hey, do you want to be on the show? And here we are, sir. Thanks for making time.
My pleasure. We're like each other's emergency guests.
I messed up. I get East Coast and Pacific Coast time messed up, so I actually had to use Google to figure out what time it was supposed to be that we were going to talk today.
Yeah, I do that too. 3 hours, FYI, everyone. Isn't that 3 hours, I think, right?
Well, you said 2 o'clock Pacific time, and it's 5 o'clock Eastern time, so...
Right. That's right. There you go.
What did we do before the internet, you know?
Yeah, I think we looked things up.
I was
in the encyclopedia.
I was actually thinking about encyclopedias the other day because I was looking at Wikipedia, and you can create, I think you can create an ebook from Wikipedia, from select Wikipedia pages. I thought that was pretty fascinating.
Oh, really? It's kind of like open source, and then you can publish it? Is that the idea?
I think you can make a PDF for if you want to read it offline. Maybe I'm completely wrong about that. But in the bottom left-hand corner, there's a column, and it says, make a book. I was like, oh, interesting. Anyway.
And then, print it out on your mimeograph machine or something? Is that the idea?
The mimeograph machine. We're dating ourselves. So you've been really cranking away on the baking of bread world over there. You're teaching classes now?
Yes. I, along with a friend of mine, Mark Stambler, and another friend, Teresa Seitz, we formed a group, a meetup group called the Los Angeles Bread Bakers back in, I think it was 2011.
And it really blew up, right?
It did, yeah. We started with 30 people. I don't know, we thought there'd be 30 people, and then there was 1,500 on the mailing list, and there seems to be a big demand for people to know how to make bread. And we built ovens, too. We built Cobb ovens and Adobe ovens, and we have at least one event a month where people basically come together and bake in one of the ovens that we put together, do a pizza bake and a bread bake, and there's usually a class, too, on the same day. And then we've done other things too. We've done just the bake sales and, you know, events and all just get together. And it's been a lot of fun.
Have you been using Meetup to coordinate the whole thing?
Yeah. Yeah, we have. And that's been nice. I mean, it's really set up to facilitate face-to-face meetings. And when you sign up, you get an email that says you're going to facilitate face-to-face meetings, right? It's not just an internet thing. And it's been good about that. And then we have some classes that are paid classes, and it kind of handles that too. So it's been very, very useful.
I haven't been to a meetup in a long time. I used to run a meetup in Brooklyn. I called it Brooklyn 2.0.
Oh, yeah? What was it about?
Well, it's just about the internet. You know, people that worked in the web world, like, we tried to get them together. And it was interesting. I met some neat people, but there were also these people that came that kind of lacked some social skills, you know?
Oh, right, right. Yeah, you know, that hasn't been the case with the bread group. Everyone's really, really nice, and they're all people who are interested in just kind of getting together and sharing recipes and experience and learning new things. It's been very positive.
I think the more niche, the more successful that kind of meetup is, actually. Because mine cast a very wide net, and I was like, we're going to meet at a bar and have beer, you know, because I never plan anything, so.
Right, right.
What has been your experience in making the bread ovens? If somebody wants to build one in their backyard, what's your suggestions?
Well, we built one in our backyard, and I have a friend of mine, lucky to have a friend, Ben Loescher, who is an architect, licensed architect, and he's doing the first Adobe buildings in Southern California with a permit in many, many years. So he knows a lot about Adobe. And he and a friend of his, Kurt Gardella, did a class in our backyard where we actually, I mean, if you dig down here in LA, in most places, there's clay.
Yeah.
And in many places in the country and the world. And if that's the case, it's really pretty easy. You just dig down, harvest the clay. It took a bit of time to figure out the right sand clay ratio because every clay is different. Every soil is different. But once we kind of locked into the right ratio, then you just add some straw and that's basically it. It's pretty simple, pretty labor intensive, a little back breaking because you got to mix that stuff up. But the process that we did for our oven and then the oven that the community oven that we built, is basically we made a bunch of bricks, adobe bricks, which are like, I don't know, something like 4x14 by something or other. That's kind of like a standard size for adobe bricks.
Yep.
And we use those to make the base. And then the top of the oven, you make a sandcastle, and then you pack that same clay, sand, straw mixture over that and form a dome. And then remove the sand out of it. And then you've got the cob or adobe oven. And it works great. I mean, it's a lot more work, obviously, than that pretty cool brick oven that you do. But the advantage with this oven is you can do bread in it in addition to pizza.
Yeah, I actually I haven't fired up my pizza oven this year yet, but that's on the to-do list. Did you have to let the thing? Do you have to fire it to like seal it or something, or do you just let it dry naturally? Because I've seen some videos where people kind of rush the process and then the oven cracks.
Yeah, that happens. Well, you let it dry out for a while, and then you do a firing. You do like progressively larger firings, and then eventually it pulls together from the inside out. And thankfully we didn't have any cracking. And part of that is getting the right mixture to clay, sand, straw, water. If you tweak that to the right ratio, then it's less likely to crack. We did a bunch of test bricks beforehand in order to get that ratio right.
Part of my backyard, there's a spring, and the people who owned it before me dug out the spring and kind of made it into like an open cistern with the spring in the bottom of it. And so they dug into the hill to open this up, and there's clay. There's been clay exposed there. And I was working there one day fixing the spring, and I dug through. You dug through like the topsoil and the leaves, and all of a sudden I hit this gray clay, and I'm like, wow. And I never really thought what to do with it. And now I have an idea of what I could do with that.
Now, you know, of course, where you are, it rains, so you'll have to do some kind of a roof over it or something. That's one thing. Adobe is, of course, ideal for L.A. and the Southwest because it's drier here. But you could still do it there. Just have to cover it.
I got a piece of tin, you know.
There you go. Huh? Like an old garage door or something, right?
Has there been any kind of aha moments lately with your bread baking? Because you've been exploring this kind of whole grain. And I don't know if it's locally ground grain, would we call it, or?
Well, I bought a mill called a Como, and I've been using that now for at least a year, maybe more, longer than a year. The aha moment is that every flour is different. And so it's exactly like making adobe bricks. You have to get the water to the flour ratio right. And it's just going to be different depending on the flour you're using, especially if you're grinding your own flour. And yeah, some of it is locally sourced. I've been able to do that. A lot of it we get from a company called Central Milling, which is out of Utah. It's a nice company. And then there's a local mill here called Griston Toll that sources stuff locally as well. And then, you know, once you start grinding your own, there's this whole world of different grains, you know, like Sonora wheat and red fife and spelt and all kinds of einkorn, all kinds of things you can fool around with. And then it is just a matter of getting the water to flour ratio right, because they're all different. They all behave differently. Some of them have more gluten in them, some of them have less. And so, you know, like some of the more tricky wheats, I'll make a loaf in a pan rather than trying to shape it into a loaf.
Yeah.
Or a hearth loaf. You just have to work with them individually and then kind of lock into one or two that you like and do them over and over again. That's sort of the key that I've found.
Have you tried mixing the different flours? You know, like because one might work better, but the other one has better flavor or something?
Yeah, exactly. No, I need to do that, actually. That's the next step. But yes, you can do that. Mix some spelt in or mix some einkorn in. I have done some rye breads that are 100% rye, and then I've done some where there's a little bit of white flour in them to get a little more texture out of them. So yeah, that's another, yeah, that's the wonderful thing about bread. It's on the one hand, it's very simple. It's just water, flour, salt. But there's so many different ways you can manipulate those three ingredients to get all kinds of different breads.
What are you using as a yeast? Do you have your own starter or are you using a commercial yeast? Or?
Yeah, I use my own starter. And that's easy to, it's easy to start a starter. You just mix water and flour and feed that every day. Keep it at room temperature. And then 2 to 3 days, it'll start to come to life. And I've kind of limited myself or focused on doing whole wheat breads, mostly 100% with a sourdough starter, because I think it's healthier. And I think it's also, you know, the flavor is more interesting. It's a deeper flavor. And so, yeah, that's what I've kind of focused on.
Yeah, it's I kind of went off the bread wagon because I am losing some weight and I stopped eating bread as one of those things. But then I was thinking that maybe, sourdough overnight risen bread might actually be, probably is healthier, but has less of a carb impact, I'm wondering, than like commercial bread.
Well, that and then 100% whole wheat too, which has a lower glycemic index, so that you just can't, I mean, it'll fill you up so much that you won't want to eat that much of it. That's the thing with 100% whole wheat breads.
All right. So you
give it a try.
You'll send me some of that bread then, so I don't have to make it.
Oh, yes. With a drone.
Hey, if you would consider supporting Garden Fork, one easy way to do it is by shopping at Amazon. There are links on each GardenFork.tv website page. It's usually on the right-hand side or at the top of the page. Or in the description of this podcast episode, there'll be an Amazon link as well. Click on that, do your shopping, and we get a little finder's fee from Amazon. All right? That'd be great. Thank you. I am fascinated by drones, and I really want one, but I'm also really concerned about the havoc and intrusion and harassment that drones could cause people, you know?
Yeah, you know, real estate agents in our neighborhood love them because they can pretend that there's a view in the neighborhood. They can kind of like put them way up in the air to show downtown to make it think that the people buying the house has a view of downtown, which is not actually the case here. But we did a drone fly over our house. I have a friend who has a drone. So I said, come on over and we'll, you know, fly over the house, see what it looks like. And it was pretty amazing, I got to say.
There's a popular YouTuber guy named Casey Neistat, which is shooting some nice stuff.
He did that great bike video.
Yeah.
I love that video, the bike lane video.
And, he's flying over Manhattan and the rivers. And I'm like, you know, the police can't like you doing this.
Right.
They don't like any object in the air. They don't know what it is.
Right. Yeah, especially where you are.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised that actually it. But anyway, but I thought it'd be really fun in the country too, but I'm just surrounded by so many trees that you really can't see what's going on in the ground. But there'd be some neat vistas, you know, but then the price of the thing is kind of prohibitive just to shoot, you know, 10 minutes of a nice vista, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I'm happy to borrow someone else's.
Oh, there you go. I'll just find out. Does anyone have one? Anyone listening?
Yeah, just invite someone as one, you know, and they'll come over and fly it for you.
I like that idea better. So neat. So I have been listening to your podcast, but maybe you could share with people what's been going on your side of the continent there.
Well, let's see. The last one was about, it was kind of a native plant person and her concerns about foraging. And then the next one, or the one after this one, actually I'm going to have you on, hopefully, this coming one. But we're going to have a forager on, Pascal Baudet, who has a new book out that's amazing. So we've done those, and we've had quite a kind of eclectic group of people.
Yes, you have.
On the podcast. Maybe too eclectic.
I'm like, oh boy.
we drifted off topic, maybe. I don't know.
I was... But, yeah. I like that you have the different forges on, because it's gotten to the point where people are, I think, ripping stuff out of the woods. And I'm like, you know, it's neat you're doing this, but you're also killing the woods, you know?
Yeah, that has been a concern here. Particularly, actually, with white sage, which... I don't know. There's been a lot of stands of that ripped out of the national forest here, which is not cool. Not cool at all.
Yeah, people use it for smudge sticks, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it's a plant that's sacred to Native Americans, and the Native Americans here are not happy, understandably, to see their sacred plants being ripped out of the forest. So, yeah. Yeah, people need to... the point of the last podcast was, Lisa was her name, was pointing out that people should grow it themselves. Now, you can't grow it where you are, but we can grow it here. And you can grow all kinds of things that you can forage for. And, of course, you can forage for plants that people consider to be invasive as well. So that's something to think about. Or at least forage responsibly and respectably. Yeah.
Like Japanese knotweed, when it's really young, is kind of like asparagus.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the young shoots, if they haven't been sprayed with glycophosphate, are edible. Yeah.
Right.
It's taking over the East. I don't know if it's out there or not, but...
Do you forage much in either of your two compounds?
Yeah, I pull a lot of dandelions out of my yard because I don't spray my yard. And I actually let dandelions grow in the raised beds. Because it's like free lettuce, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And then I do some mushroom foraging. There's oyster mushrooms are really prevalent in the late summer when it rains. They pop out all over the place. So I don't feel too bad about taking a small bag of oyster mushrooms.
How did you learn that? I've always been a little wary of mushroom foraging.
Well, I took a class. There was the next town over's conservation society had a class, and it kind of brought out of the woodwork all the mycology people. Is that the word?
Yep, that's it.
And they were pointing out different things, and some of them were like arcane, like, oh, this is a blah, 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 and first you have to blanch it and then squeeze the water out and then blah, blah. And I'm like, and they pointed out, they're called honey mushrooms or like a button mushroom, and they pointed out oysters, and I'm like... Okay, the oyster, I also have three different guidebooks. My favorite is the Audubon Pocket Guidebook, which has excellent photos. And there's a couple, like oysters, there are not a lot of similar mushrooms that are poison. I don't think there are any that are poisonous.
It's very distinctive then.
Right. And then there's Hen of the Woods, which is also called Maitake, which looks like, it's sometimes called Turkey Tail. And it's very distinctive as well, so... That's what I stick to. There are these other things that pop out of the ground and they have these dots on them. And I'm like, I don't know what it is. It's beautiful, but I don't know what it is. So.
Right.
One of your friends knows mushroom foraging. You just have to ask.
Oh, yeah. I know some people here. And then there's the local mycological society. I've gone to some of their meetings. It's a lot drier here. So
that's true.
I have to go up in the mountains to find stuff, and we've been in a drought for many years now. Yeah. So it's been a little tough.
What's interesting here is that in Connecticut the soil is more alkaline, and right across the New York border up there, my friends live right across the New York Connecticut border, and the soil type changes, and there are tons of morels over there and maitakes. Okay. Which is weird.
Wow.
And we're in the same latitude, and it's only 40 miles away, but it's a different soil type, so it's very interesting.
Mm. Interesting.
Yeah, who knew? So we were talking, before we started recording, we were talking about bees and my bee dilemmas. How are your honeybees been over there?
Well, you know, I need to poke in and take a look at how they're doing. They seem to be okay. They made it through the winter, such as the winter is here. And they seem to be okay. I did have a swarm myself, actually, and I caught a swarm in the backyard, which I don't know whether it was mine or not, but yeah, there were, and then I don't know about you, but my phone kind of rings off the hook around swarm season with people with various bee issues that then I go take care of.
Oh, I haven't had that. There's some, well, actually up in the country, there aren't very many honeybees. So, but down in the city here, the police have a couple of beekeepers that are also policemen. And so they call them.
Yeah, some of the fire departments have that here. But there's so many, maybe it's our climate is just the perfect place for bees because it doesn't freeze here. So there's just so many bees. And they're in walls and they're in, you know, electrical boxes and hot tubs. And they're all over the place.
Yeah, here it's they're mainly on a tree or a mailbox or something like that. It's kind of spectacular when it happens in Manhattan, but...
Yeah, you know, actually, I got to see... Well, this is a funny story. I had a swarm box, which is a small, you know, box that you put around in case your bees swarm, the hope that they'll go in the box. And I had it on a shed roof near my hives for years. And finally, I'm cleaning up. I'm like, that thing's ugly. I'm going to get it off the roof. So I take it off the roof. I throw it kind of sideways and upside down into a pot full of chicken manure. And I ignore it. And then a week later, Kelly's like, you got to come up now. I'm talking to some neighbor down the street. I run up and there's a swarm moving into the swarm box that's sitting in the chicken manure pot. So, which if anyone hasn't seen it, it's spectacular when that happens. I mean, it's amazing to see them in that force just moving in there. And so they moved in, and I mean, like, as soon as they moved in, I put it in a better place, and then I gave it away to someone. So there you go.
How many hives? Bees. How many hives do you have in the yard?
I just have two because we're in tight quarters here, and I figure that's the responsible number.
There it is.
Yeah, how about
this,
you?
I have two in Connecticut, and I have one down in New York, and eventually we'll have two in New York. I went to visit a fellow Brooklyn beekeeper yesterday over in Bed-Stuy, and she keeps her bees in a community garden, and she has five or six hives over there, and one of them had three honey supers on it already, and they were all full.
Wow.
That's like 120 pounds of honey.
Yeah, that's crazy. Where are your New York bees?
They're right next to, it's called Greenwood Cemetery, which is in Brooklyn off of Fifth Avenue. It's near Sunset Park and below Park Slope, if anyone...
I've heard of it, yes.
Yeah. So it's a 500-acre botanic garden.
And they're on a... Right. And they're on a rooftop, or...?
Yeah, they're on a roof, and we actually just shot a 360 video, one of those virtual reality 360 videos of my friend Brian and I checking the hive on the roof.
You know, it's funny. I had the very same idea last week. I'm like, I gotta shoot some kind of VR thing. Like, what about bees? How did you do that?
Well, Brian bought an relatively inexpensive 360 camera called a Theta, Theta. It's about $350. Yeah. And we went to, YouTube has a lab and a studio in New York City, and they offered this workshop. So, like, they invited, like, 12 of us to go. You know, we expressed an interest, and they showed us how to do it. And so then we went up on the roof and made this video. By the time this podcast goes, it'll be posted next week, the 360 video. But it shows us coming up out of the roof, you know, out of the stairwell, the hatch, and looking at because the queen died, and we were looking for the queen. It's just kind of spectacular because you can watch it on your smartphone. If you hold your smartphone at eye level and then you spin your body, you know, you stay in one place, but just kind of pirouette around or tilt up and tilt down. It shows you, it's like you are standing there next to us looking at the bees. And then you can turn around and look, oh, there's Manhattan. Oh, there's the Statue of Liberty. Oh, there's the cemetery. You know, it's a super wide angle of view. But we're shooting a couple of more of these 360 videos because it's kind of got me reinterested in video again. So
yeah. No, I really wanted to try that myself. Now, it's the dumb question: is not 3D or is it 1D?
It's one dimensional, but 2D, it is a 360 degree panoramic.
Okay.
And you can literally use the YouTube app on your smartphone and you stand there. And it uses it's not the gyrometer,
the gyroscope,
I guess it is, or something like that, in the phone to determine if you're lifting it up or down or spinning it left or right. The motion sensors in the camera. And it's pretty cool. Or you can use the Google Cardboard, which is the Google's answer to virtual reality goggles, which are they're all of a dollar and they work fantastic. And with those, you can put them on and walk around and go, hey, look at me, you know? So,
yeah, I just tried those myself, though.
It's a lot of fun. And you could probably borrow or rent the Theta camera. There's a couple other brands out there, but they're all in that. That's the most inexpensive one, I think. Brian is a videographer. It's a profession, and it's another tool he can use. So he was very excited, and I was like, well, we'll make some for Garden Fork. So I'm going to make some more this weekend. The only problem is you can't, there's no one behind the camera. You can't shoot something and then have a crew behind the camera because the camera shows everything. So you have to
clear. Does that mean we'll get to see your camera operator, your famous camera operator?
That means she won't be there. yeah, she has no desire to be on it, so I can't blame. Maybe she'll wear one of those wigs like Sia the singer does. You know, see, she covers her face with the wig. So
perfect.
But yeah, that's pretty exciting. It's kind of hard to show close up stuff. And we shot some more stuff in Brian's backyard and it didn't work out very well, but it's neat. I don't know if we're going to shoot everything in 360 from now on, but it was fun to play with and we're going to do some more of those. So yeah.
Very cool.
If you lived here, I could loan it to you, but you're over there.
Yeah. Well, you could fly it with your drone over here. Right.
So. Yeah. All right. Well, just to finish up, one other thing I wanted to ask you is, we had talked about this a long time ago, but are you doing any more of the straw bale gardening?
You know, we have not. No, although I kind of regret it this year, maybe not doing that because I've got this bed I've got to prepare, and it's already getting late in the season. And I thought, I should have done a straw bale again because it worked really, really well. And then I talked to another podcaster who used to be in your neck of the woods, a guy named who goes by the name KMO and does what he calls the Sea Realm podcast. Mm. And he just interviewed me on, he has a Vermont radio show now. He moved to Vermont and he's getting really into straw bale gardening.
It was on my to-do list this year and then it kind of got past me. But could I still start one now? I mean, do I have to prepare a lot or...
You have to prepare the bales, but that can be done in about 2 weeks with some nitrogen fertilizer. So I think, I don't know what your season's like, how long you have, but you could probably do some still.
All right. I got to go get some bales then. I got to figure out which of my neighbors has, or maybe the Agway has some straw or something. It's got to be straw, not hay, right?
Actually, I think you could use either, but straw is a lot more cheap here rather than hay. It's a lot cheaper.
Oh, I didn't think of that. Yeah.
Oh, the other thing is that hay, you'll get more weed seeds growing out of.
Yeah, my neighbors bale their hay, but they do those giant round bales. So.
Oh yeah, I don't know if I don't know if that would work. They'd be too huge. Probably.
Yeah, they're almost they're as tall as me. So.
Yeah, that would be a problem.
But they're better for storage for them because they take them and pack them into this giant plastic tube and they keep them for winter that way. It's pretty neat.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I wonder if the grass ferments in there.
Oh, good question. Well, they probably try to keep it dry, right?
Yeah. So. I don't know. All right. Well, cool. Well, thanks for taking the time here, sir.
My pleasure, Eric.
Guys, if you have any comments, it's radio@gardenfork.tv, and you can find Eric over at rootsimple.com, or just go to iTunes for their eclectic podcast, and it is just Root Simple, right?
It is just rootsimple.com.
All right, great. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Eric.
Hey, everyone, real quick, if you do us a favor, go to your computer, log on to iTunes, and write a review, a 5-star review, hopefully, of Garden Fork Radio. If you'd use words like DIY, food, podcast, cooking, gardening, that'd be cool too, right? Just go to iTunes, say nice things about us, That'll really help us in the search on iTunes so more people can find Garden Fork and listen to cool stuff. Thanks.
Garden Fork's theme music is used under license from uniquetracks.com.